Welcome, listeners, to another episode of Pateo Radio, brought to you via Finding Voices Radio. My name is Johan Oldenkamp. I'm the host of this radio talk show, and it's now Wednesday, October 29, 2014. The guest of this episode is Ole Demmegaard. He was born in Denmark, then he went when he moved when he was 8 years old to Sweden, and now he is living in Spain. Ole, welcome into the broadcast.
Thank you so much, Johan.
Yeah, you've done many radio broadcasts before. I think you're not counting that anymore, because it must be something like 100 or something.
Yeah, at least I think so.
Yeah, I think so too. I saw on your website many. Can you give a short introduction of yourself? What kind of human being are you before we dive into all the assassinations?
Okay. I don't know what kind of human being I am. I think we're quite alike. But like you say, I was born in Denmark. I moved to Sweden when I was a kid, and I grew up in a family that was very much involved in the resistance movement against the German occupation. Mm-hmm. And I think I all the way from being a child, I got this in my genes, how important it is to stand up for what is true and right, even though it can be very scary at times. And after we moved to Sweden, I started working as a journalist, and that brought me down this line of investigation that it hasn't been my job, but I spent more than 30 years doing it on my own, trying to sort out the major assassinations like the JFK, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme. I was totally focused for more than 12 years, doing everything I could to reveal what actually happened there, because what we are being told, the official story, it's an absolute lie. Then it came to a point where I, together with some other people, got too close to the truth. Two of my friends, very sadly, was murdered. Whoa. And I was threatened as well, so I decided to leave Sweden before I became part of statistics, if you know what I mean.
I understand what you mean.
So this is the reason why I live in Spain now.
Okay. Whoa, that's kind of threatening. So, your revelations were too threatening for the powers that be. Do want to conceal the true story, so to say.
This is the thing. I mean, these so-called powerful people, the only thing they have problems with is the truth, mm-hmm. You know, and people standing up for peace and unity, all these beautiful things that most normal people would like, that is what is a threat towards them. Their agenda is death and destruction, and they're very efficient in their way of dealing with problems, but the way they deal with problems, so-called problems, is very brutal many times. And so truth seekers, or people who don't give up, or very stubborn like myself, become a major concern to them, and sometimes they take us out. It's a scary one, because it's like walking in a minefield, and you never know if you stepped on a mine until it's too late. You know, it's only afterwards you find out that, oh my God, now I overdid it. And that's normally when you got a bullet in your head or something like that. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay, yeah. What I would like to do with you, Ole, is to discuss some of those assassinations and other events as well. And then we can see if there is indeed a kind of a general pattern, as you claim. I think your own quest started with the assassination of Olof Palme in 1986. What did you discover about that assassination?
No, it started earlier than that. In the early 80s, I became very, very interested in the JFK assassination, almost obsessed, I would say, because I really buried myself in that case. And that I read a couple of hundred books in that area and saw all the documentaries I could get hold of and so on. But this was way before the JFK movie and so on. It was at a time where most people had no idea about the real truth behind it. And then that led me down a route going into the Robert Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, and so on. And while I was doing this, I started writing a book for my own sake, just because, especially the JFK assassination, it's extremely complex and multi-layered. So just to be able to get a more clearer picture of it all, I started writing a book, and it ended up with 500, 600 pages, just trying to keep the different layers apart and so on. And one of the things I found very, very confusing for a long time was that the same person could be described in one very credible book as a CIA asset. Then the same person in another very credible book could be described as a member of the mob. And in a third one, he could be working for the Secret Service. And in a fourth one, he could be paid by the FBI and so on. And I found that very, very confusing for a while, until I discovered that it was all true, that the same person could work for the CIA, be used as a hitman for the mob, be financed by the FBI from time to time, and do extra work for the CIA and so on. So that led me into an understanding of how much these so-called agencies are in bed with each other, that the CIA and the mob, it's just like two different sides of the same coin. The DIA and the FBI and so on, they're so interconnected, and core elements in these organizations have become so extremely corrupt nowadays that they are behind so much of this mayhem, or they're being used as a tool to create so much of this mayhem that we're seeing today.
Exactly. So it is actually true what we see in most Hollywood films, that there are assets who can be used for any kind of dirty job, so to say, and they are highly skilled, highly trained murderers. Can be used by any agenda, so as they want. Is that correct? Yeah.
Do you know? Yeah, it's totally correct. And do you know, it's called the CIA, the Secret Intelligence, no, the Central Intelligence Agency. And the word agency, that really describes that this is a company, more or less, that is for hire. Any big corporation that needs to sort of get some things done in foreign countries or wherever, just use the CIA for it. And it has become like a monster of its own, with a totally own agenda and so on. So it's totally out of control nowadays.
Indeed, and that's that out of control agency is creating more and more out of control organizations like the IS, Islamic State, and Al Qaeda, and so on. But we're not going to that. Maybe just for listeners, it might be interesting to dive into one of these cases. I think the most famous one is the JFK. What did you find out about this assassination? What was the reason? And yeah. Can you give us some clues that might be interesting?
I can name all the shooters. I can name, all the spotters, the breakdown guys, the walkie-talkie people, how they got in and out of Dallas, what the agenda was, and so on. I've spent 30 years of my life tracking these people down, and I also, without bragging, I've been welcomed as one of the world's leading experts in this area. So whatever you want to know about it, I'll be happy to tell you.
Whoa, I'm impressed, though. I'm really impressed. Yeah, you wrote a couple of books. Maybe this is in one of your books too, eh? I assume.
It's
Yeah.
I've written four books, and one of the books that is about this area is called Coup d'État in Slow Motion. Coup
Okay.
d'État in Slow Motion. It is about the Swedish assassination, or the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister. It was absolutely not a Swedish, what do you call it, deed. It was not done by Swedes. There was a certain elements of Swede involved. I've identified all the people involved in this one as well. There were names and photos and all of this in my book, Coup d'État in Slow Motion. You can find it on lightonconspiracies.com. And I tell you, one of the things that I found when it came to these major, major political hits is that I thought that these were totally separated. I had no idea that there was any connection between these crimes when I started out 30 years ago. But down the line, over all of these years, it started leading me down the same track again and again and again and again. And I managed to identify people when it came to, for instance, the assassination of Olof Palme and the assassination of JFK, 23 years apart. I've identified people who were in Dealey Plaza when the shots were fired, who were in Stockholm 23 years later, taking part of the Swedish assassination as well. And it is incredible. It turns out that not only is it the same, they call themselves the elite. I would prefer calling them the minority because they are actually very, very few compared to the rest of us. But they are a few thousand people that are in this sort of like a hidden world government. And it turns out that they have used the same team of assassins. The core group of that team has been working ever since the late 50s, all the way up until today, with many different offsprings into other groups and organizations. But the core group there has been there. And if you would like, I can just go into some details around that that will connect these many of these major assassinations, just to give you a glimpse of it.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. Please go ahead.
Okay, in the late 50s, it's very important to understand that after the Second World War, the world changed directions. And for people who are not aware of it, if you start studying the financial structure behind the Second World War and the First World War as well, and many, many other things before all of this happened, you will see that it's the same founders on both sides of the major conflicts in most wars, including the Second World War. And the finances behind Hitler were, for instance, you had the Rockefeller, the Rothschilds, but you also had the Bush family, Prescott Bush, who is the grandfather of the latest president and the father of George Bush Sr. Prescott Bush was one of the founders of the Hitler war machine. Not saying that he was the one paying out of his own pocket, but he was the guy who funneled the funds from the the military industrial complex and so on many, many major companies and so on into IG Farben that was behind Hitler and so on. Then
Indeed, yeah. Yeah, people
after
can
this.
find, sorry, just a little bit of adding here. People can find on the internet a document where his name and signature are under a financial construction for the Nazis in Germany. So the evidence is all available. Please
Yeah,
go ahead, Ola, yeah.
he was accused of treason and he was almost tried for it as well after the Second World War. But that was just a show for the masses because he was in the pocket of these big guys that was totally covering him. And so, two of the people as well that was very much involved with Hitler as lawyers, there were two brothers from Wall Street, Alan and John Foster Dulles. Now, Alan Dulles is a very central figure in all of this because when the Second World War ended and the whole world was like, oh, thank God we got rid of this Nazi threat, just because 12 people had to sit in the trial in Nuremberg. What happened afterwards that they had took the fall, but instead of the Nazi threat being eradicated, instead what was called Operation Paperclip was arranged by people like Alan Dulles. This Operation Paperclip was like they organized like rat lines through the Vatican, exporting all of these hardened veterans, Nazi veterans. We're talking about 1,600, anything from scientists to people in the military intelligence to Gestapo to Abwehr to all of these people were exported out of Nazi Germany and into countries like the US and then many other countries in the Latin America and South America and so on. But in the States, under the surveillance of people like Alan Dulles, who were in the so-called OSS, that this organization then turned into what was later called the CIA. And here is where many of these people were integrated, these hardened Nazis, into organizing OSS that is now the CIA. They were also part of creating things like NASA with the rocket scientists like Wernher von Braun and so on. They were also part of creating this so-called company CDC that we now see is very central in this whole Ebola hoax that is going on now. Extreme scaremongering, trying to push people into taking these awful, awful, awful vaccines that are created by laboratories that is also based on the same foundations of these scientists and so on. Things you really, I cannot say how much you need to stay away from these needles because this is very, very scary. There's a documentary by a very, very skilled doctor. His name is Leonard Horovitz. You can find it on YouTube. It's an old one. It's called In Lies We Trust. And he shows the whole background, how Ebola and the AIDS virus was created in laboratories in the 70s and so on, how the whole thing was set up, you know, like bioweapons and so on. It can be a very good idea in these days when people are quite afraid of this. I would say calm down, no reason to panic. The Ebola exists, but it is a lot going on here, scaremongering, just to get you to take the vaccine. That is what they're after. But let me get back to where I lost the thread there for a while. Anyway, so after the Second World War, the Alan Dulles and the CIA was created, and then in the late 1950s and beginning of 1960s, Alan Dulles and some other people came up with the idea that why don't we create a top team of assassins that can be used globally, a super secret team that nobody will know of, but that we can use wherever we want against whoever we see fit, you know, globally. So what they did, this was under the President Dwight Eisenhower. So they went through the Vice President Richard Nixon at that time to get him to create this team of assassins. And what Nixon was, he gave this order to CIA veterans like David Attlee Phillips, like Ted Shackley, the so-called Blonde Ghost, and E. Howard Hunt. These three people were the main people that went down to Miami and started recruiting people for this hit team. And what they did was they recruited mostly exiled Cubans that had just left Cuba when Castro took over. These were very, very hard people, disciplined killers, and most of them coming from the Batista regime, you know, police officer from the Air Force, jungle warfare, you name it. And so a group was organized, and this group, very ultra secret group, went under the name Operation 40. It was not that there were 40 people, there were actually about 85, 85 men and one woman. And they were trained in outside Louisiana, they were trained in Florida, and they were trained in Guatemala in everything from jungle warfare to blowing up anything that could kill a person. They were trained in it, poison, explosives, knives, whatever, whatever. So this team was getting ready in the early 60s to take on their first tasks, and they were very much involved in several attempts on Fidel Castro's life. Then we came to a point where suddenly JFK, after having been quite easily manipulated by the powers behind the scenes, it came to, I think it was at the Cuban Missile Crisis, when it came to a point where JFK was more or less sitting with a finger on the button that could have started the Third World War, nuclear war, and because of a threat from Russia. They managed to avoid that, even though the whole military industrial complex was trying to get him to press this button because they wanted war, war, war. And JFK was sitting there with tears in his eyes, just saying, "I refuse to be the one that do this to the world." And after that crisis, it seems like he almost had like a revelation, like like an enlightened moment where he just said, "This enough is enough." That he understood the magnitude of madness he was getting involved in. So from that point, suddenly he started going in a totally different direction, where he said, "I'm going to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces. I'm going to withdraw out of Vietnam." Vietnam wasn't even started on the American part. It was a French war that they took over. I'm going to withdraw out of Vietnam. I'm going to start printing our own money so we get out of the Federal Reserve Bank's strangulation grip, and so on. And he just totally shook the whole thing. He also fired Alan Dulles and two other people in this in the CIA. Absolute unheard of, you know, three holy cows in that organization. And also he put his brother in as a minister of justice to track down the mob and get rid of them, totally eliminate them. And in 1 year, the amount of verdicts against the mob was raised by about 700% after Robert Kennedy started hunting them down. So it was unreal. So this made a lot of people very, very angry in the mob. They had helped JFK to get into power. They helped his father fix the or rig the election in Illinois and so on. And now suddenly JFK, once he was in the White House, he turned his back on them. So they were very, very angry. And the CIA was angry. Lyndon Johnson was angry. So many people around him were so, so upset, including the FBI, where J. Edgar Hoover knew that he was going, if JFK would be re-elected again, he would be thrown out, you know. So all of them answered, gathered together to take JFK out. And the tool they used was, to a main degree, Operation 40. In the JFK assassination, if you want to later, I can go through all the shooters, and you will see a major part of the shooters, because there are multiple shooters surrounding Dealey Plaza, shooting from all different directions, and many of them were members of Operation 40. Now, if you go down the line a few years, there was, for instance, one man in this group. His name was David Morales. He was one of the getaway drivers in Dealey Plaza for three of the shooters, and he was involved in many, many assassinations in later years as well. He was named the CIA Assassin of the Year in Latin America, top assassin in Latin America. Now, this David Morales, he was also at the Ambassador Hotel 1968 when Robert Kennedy was shot. He and two other top CIA officials, George Dionides and Gordon Campbell, these three people were overseeing the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Not that they were the ones firing the shots, they were there to check the whole thing and see that everything went smooth. And he was later also the killer of Che Guevara down in Bolivia, where he and another key player in Operation 40, Felix Rodriguez, tracked down Che Guevara. Che Guevara was Fidel Castro's companion, and eliminated him, got him killed. And it was David Morales who was the one firing the fatal shot. So you will see that these are connected. Then Felix Rodriguez was later one of the burglars in the Watergate burglary, where all of the members that was these people that were arrested for the Watergate break-in, all of them connected to Operation 40. Then you have the killing of John Lennon. The night that he was shot, this was many years later. I'm just showing you that these people have been active. When he came, he was also one of these people standing up for peace and unity and these things, a major threat to the military-industrial complex, who just want the wars to go on and on and on. And he was just about to make his comeback after many years. And so he came together with Yoko Ono from the studio. They arrived outside the Dakota building in New York. And Mark Chapman, the guy who's still in prison, who's said to have shot him, was standing to the right. And Yoko left the car first, started walking into the building, and John followed some five, 6 meters after him, after her, when suddenly, five, six shots were fired, and John went down. He started crawling in. They got an ambulance and drove him off, where he was later pronounced dead. But when you look at that assassination, like all assassinations that I look into, I try to go in with a clean mind, no opinions beforehand. and just check out the evidence. What does it say? What did the witnesses see, the absolute first reports and so on? And when you look at this assassination, you had Mark Chapman was standing behind him and to the right. So of course, all shots were fired that killed John from behind and to the right. Absolutely not. They were fired straight from the left. So a good question would be, who was standing to the left? And this evening, it was a very nice looking gentleman that was working extra as a doorman. His name was Jose Perdomo. And if you track him down, for 10 years, he was one of the highest ranking officers in Operation 40. You go to figure, how big are the chances for one of the top assassins in America standing at the exact spot where the shots were fired from, and call that a coincidence? Now, if we... No,
whoa,
please interrupt me.
No, I don't want to interrupt you. I'm listening with all my ears on, so to say. So please go ahead. I'm fascinated with what you're saying.
Okay, so if we go back to Dealey Plaza, now when Operation 40 was created, the man that was put in charge to be the paymaster for this Operation 40 was a man that you know very well. His name was George Bush Sr.
Mm-hmm.
He was the paymaster. He was a young man at that time, but he was the one that funneled the funds into this team of assassins from companies like Standard Oil, United Fruit, the military industrial complex, oil tycoons in Texas, and so on. And when the shots were fired, George Bush, if I'm correct, and I truly believe I am after all of these years, he was in the Deltex building when the shots were fired. That the Deltex building is the one, it's the building to the right of the Texas School Book Depository. If you want to, I can just go quickly through the different shooters, as far as I know, where they were positioned and what they were doing.
Yeah, that's this... great. I already knew that George W. Bush was there. The senior Bush, George,
yeah.
Herbert Walker Bush was there, and that he was later promoted to be the director of CIA, and then later, of course, the USA president. So, but you are even more specific. He had a clear role there. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Ole. Please continue.
No, George Bush Sr. is very, very central in these things. From the day he entered, he fought his way, or he killed his way to the top, I would say. He went, he got in there, he infiltrated and killed all the people around him to get to the top position. Very, 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 I would say, I don't use this word often, but evil person. I got that from friends or people who used to work for him, the way they describe him. I'm a personal friend of Chip Tatum, who was the commander of George Bush Sr.'s hit team of assassins. It was called Pegasus, and they personally carried out about 17 assassinations globally under the order of George Bush Sr. And this is the way he describes him: very, very intelligent, a super tactic, very good at planning events and so on, but pure evil, pure absolute. He says. Chip Tatum has been 25 years surrounded by assassins and mercenaries and so on. He says George Bush Sr., the most evil person he has ever met. So that says a lot. Anyway, in the Deltex building, you had like multiple shooters in many different positions. And if we go to the Deltex building, the team in that building was led in by a man, an LA mobster from, his name was Hale Braden. His only task was to open the back door and let them in so that they could enter up to the second floor where there was a mining company that was a CIA front company, and they let them in there so that they could get a good angle for the shooting down on the street level. And the shooter from that window, his name was Chucky Nicoletti. He was the lieutenant under Sam Giancana, a Chicago mobster. So the shooter there, Chucky Nicoletti, and the spotter, because they are almost always these teams of assassins, they are very often, if it's like rifle shooting and so on, it will, or sniper rifles, it would be a team of two or three. One shooter, his task is only to focus on hitting the target. And then you have a spotter. His task is to, with what do you call it, binoculars and a radio, check that everything is going according to plan, who's the victim, see to that and no interference will be done. And then sometimes there's a third guy. He's called the so-called breakdown guy. As soon as the shots are fired, the weapon will be thrown to him. He will dismantle it into several pieces if it's one of these, which it normally is. He will also see that no evidence is left behind, and he will take the weapon and get it out of in a totally different direction than the shooter, so that in seconds, boom, the weapon is on one, is in going in one direction, the shooter is in another, together with the spotter. So they're out of there within 30 seconds. In this, the Daltex building, the shooter, like I said, Chucky Nicoletti, the spotter was a man called Tony Izquierdo, a mercenary and very closely associated to Operation 40. There's a statue of him in Miami today, by the way. Anyway, then also you had Johnny Rosselli, who later ended up chopped up in a barrel out in Hudson Bay. He was the liaison between, he was a former hitman for Al Capone in the old days, but when he got older, he was the liaison between the mob and Los Angeles, the whole film industry and so on, and the CIA. So he was sort of the guy in between. This day he was supposed to be a shooter as well, but he backed out because there were rumors that this task was being blown off, that the operation was called off. And that's about it. And then you've got George Bush in there as well. So quite a crowded room there. Then if we go over to the Texas School Book Depository, up where Lee Harvey Oswald is said to have been, he was absolutely innocent to this whole thing. He was actually, in my opinion, a real hero because he knew what was going down and he did everything he could to stop it. He was the guy who sent out the telex over the FBI trying to expose what was going on and so. And instead, he had to take the fall and he became the patsy and died for it. So I hope that history will look totally different upon him because I truly see him as a hero. Anyway, up where he's said to have been located in the so-called sniper's nest, there were three people on that floor. And the shooter up there, his name was Eladio Del Valle. He was, many of these people met a very violent death afterwards, but Eladio Del Valle was up there, who's a former Batista agent, member of Operation 40. And the spotter on that floor was a black man, also member of Operation 40, Herminio Diaz Garcia. And then in the window to the furthest to the left, if you stand in front of the building, the shooter up there was a former Chicago police officer. I got a total blank out here. Well, I'm going to get back to his name.
Yeah, it's okay. You're doing
I'm sorry, I lost it there.
No, it's okay. You're doing everything by heart. You're not reading anything. You'll have
Not at
this.
all. Not at all.
Whoa. Okay.
Anyway, I'll get
Okay.
back to him because
Yeah.
he was also the right hand of mobster Sam Giancana, who was actually staying at the Adolphus Hotel just down the road when the shootings took place, Sam Giancana. And I believe that is where the whole operation was controlled from, that the control center was at this Adolphus Hotel. But then, if we go down on street level, you got where Abraham Zapruder was standing in front of just when when Kennedy was hit the first time from the front, when you see that he raises his arms. If you look at that, there's one man with an umbrella, a black umbrella. He's called the Umbrella Man. Richard Kane, sorry, was the name of the shooter up on the in the window to the furthest to the left, Richard Kane.
Okay.
Anyway, we go down, and the Umbrella Man. There have been many theories about what was he doing there. You know, what did he have? Sort of like a poison arrow? Was it a secret gun? Because it was a sunny day at that time. The sun was out, blue sky. So why was he standing there with a black umbrella? The task that he had was to show the exact point for the crossfire, so that all shooters in all different positions would fire at the same time. because they wanted to be able to nail this on one single patsy, one lone crazy guy, as they were always want. And they couldn't have like 25 shots being fired in a long row over 15 seconds. They needed to have them all at the same time so that any additional shots could be blamed on echoes or something like that, which they really tried to pull off. Well, the name of the man who stood with the umbrella, his name was Roy Hargraves, and he was very strongly connected to Operation 40 as well, a mercenary. Then there's a guy right in front of him, quite a dark skinned Cuban looking man. He is a Cuban. And he almost steps out in the street in front of the limo, waving. This man, his name was Felipe Vidal Santiago. He very closely connected to Operation 40. And this man, under many years after this event, worked for the CIA for a front company called IT&T, a CIA front. And his task was to go around in different countries where they were planning an assassination to take out someone. And his task was to go there and recruit people as part of the team of assassins, or recruit them as a shooter or something like that. But most of the time, to let this guy that was recruited go down as a patsy, you know, to get the blame for it. These people often ended up dead, committing suicide or whatever. At least that was, or suicided, I would call them. But he went under the alias of Charles Morgan on the many, many, many years. And if you fast forward to the fall of 1985, which is just a few months before the killing of Olof Palme, Charles Morgan, Felipe Vidal Santiago, turned up in Stockholm trying to recruit killers in Stockholm to be part of taking out Olof Palme. So here we have a direct connection between Dealey Plaza and the people behind the assassination of Olof Palme and JFK, and 23 years later, on location in Stockholm, trying to get killers in part of taking out Olof Palme, connecting the two and connecting the powers behind these assassinations as well. My book, Coup d'État in Slow Motion, it's 1,100 pages. I mean, this killing is officially blamed on a one single lone crazy guy, alcoholic guy. My book, that is, it just packed with photos and facts, shows you a possible different version of what was going down this evening. I tell you, that assassination's unreal. The level of complexity and the level of different elements. I've done a 9-hour interview on Red Eyes Creations just about the JFK assassination, no, about the Olof Palme assassination and all the different aspects to it. It is absolutely incredible, that assassination.
Wow.
But if we.
Yeah, I'm now currently at your website, Ola. If people go to lightonconspiracy.com, you already mentioned it yourself, there you see a book and you can order it for, I see, 20 euros, 19.95. But it's also available as a PDF, so maybe you can tell people how they can order the digital version if they don't want to buy the printed one.
No, it's only available as a PDF
Oh, okay.
because every time I tried to get it published, it's been stopped. Just 6 months ago, I signed a contract with an American publisher, and just before it went into print, they canceled it due to technical issues, whatever that means.
Okay.
So,
Yeah.
and I the agent for Michael Moore, he had it, and he said he gave it back after a few months. He said, anyone that published this will be sued from here to the moon. He named it a bomb of truth, and so I'm just saying, it's not just, it's 30 years of my life put into this, but there's a lot that they don't want to get out there, you know,
Okay.
and for a reason. And I, like I say, this is not my theory. I present a jigsaw puzzle put together, and you can just go through the facts yourself and make up your own opinion. Never buy anything, never swallow anything that is presented to you, I would suggest. It also said on the cover, read it, make up your own mind, and if it makes sense, then spread it.
How did you get into How was all this knowledge coming to you, all this information? Were people helping you, insiders, or just like you said, the friend that you talked about, he was,
This is lately, you know, it's how it doesn't come for free. You know, you really had to dig your way into it, because this is information that is hidden most of the time. They really try to cover it up.
Indeed.
So I'm just an ordinary guy, you know. I don't know why I became so obsessed with this, and I have no benefit in doing it. I have no gain in doing it. I risked my own life, you know, several times, and I had, like I said, I have friends who died around me. When you start seeing the level of madness behind this group and what they're spreading, all this, I'm after all of these years, so much of these so-called terror acts and assassinations and so on are inside jobs. I tell you, to this day, after so many years, I don't even know if there is such a thing as a real terrorist anymore, because every single time I look into it, and it's almost like on a global scale, it brings me back to the same group again and again and again. It doesn't matter if it's Al-Qaeda, I mean, when they couldn't pull that one off anymore and renamed it into ISIS. It's the same story there. That it's the same story behind 9/11, Oklahoma City, the Oslo bombings, the London bombings, the Madrid bombings, the killing of, it's just like unreal when you see how much these people are involved in. At the same time, it gives me great, great hope, and I feel super optimistic about the future, because it's not that I'm living in a crazy world with crazy people running around shooting each other and placing bombs everywhere. It's a small little group terrorizing us. There's so few, there's so few, and we are so many that it's absolutely ridiculous in one way that we are having programs like this. You know, we should have woken up for so long ago, but we've been so deeply asleep, you know, not letting them get away with this for such a long time.
That's really true. I, in my books, I'd cover a little bit of this, and I also show some patterns here. I think for the audience, because most of the listeners are from the Netherlands, you also investigated the so-called attack on Queen's Day in the Netherlands in 2009 on April 30. Can you give us a little bit of insight in what you discovered on that?
Do you know, very often they carry these things out in a ritualistic way. I don't normally go into this area, but very often on the location where somebody is taken out, if it's on a high level or where the so-called terror act is done, it is very often connected to a certain date, or also the position of the hit can be very revealing, you know. Yeah. So when you look at it, very often there's an obelisk nearby, for instance, that is a Freemasonry symbol for the male power. That one keeps repeating. The eternal flame is another one that keeps popping up. And the pyramid shape of streets, for instance, where you will see that, just like on Dealey Plaza, you will see the streets are very odd when you look from above. You can go Google map them, and you will see this exact pyramid shape where he was hit, you know. And sometimes they try to do the hit on the exact top of the pyramid. Okay, so you go to, it was an Appeldom, is that a Dorf? Isn't that the way you pronounce it, the name in Holland?
Yeah, you say Appeldoorn, but it's okay.
Appeldom, okay, yeah. Appeldom.
Yeah.
Okay, you see this thing, and I also want to say that many, many times lately, from 2001 and onwards, many of these so-called events are so-called false flag operations. They are not real events. They look real on TV when they're pumped out through media, but they are not. In many of these events, like the beheading in Woolwich and many of the mass shootings, the Boston mass shooting, the Sandy Hook and so on, nobody got hurt. They used actors. Crisisactors.org is one of the places you can go and hire these people. And they set up these things because they work with different old Roman templates. One of the favorites is a one called problem, reaction, solution. They secretly create a problem to get a reaction from you so that they can present their agenda. And this agenda is something that we would never accept had it not been for the problem. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
And
sure.
so when it came to this thing in Apeldoorn, if you look at it, if you look at it, go into that area on Google Map, it's a perfect example. You Google Map and you check it out, and exactly when this happened, I'm sure your listeners will remember exactly what was taking place and so on. That there was this car, just the Queen was in this bus together with her family, this double-decker bus. They were coming through the crowds and they were slowly going towards bypassing an obelisk and then going towards a hotel nearby. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, came this car and just it looked like it was aiming towards the bus, but instead it crashed right into this obelisk. Now, if you look on a Google map, you will see that the streets, the design of the streets in that area are an exact pyramid shape, exact, and on the very top of it is an old big obelisk. Okay, the guy came from absolute nowhere. These streets behind were closed off, so there's how he got in there is a mystery. And also, how could he time this in any way possible without having been guided from a helicopter or somebody with or radio contact or so on? What I'm suggesting here, no disrespect to anyone who lost loved ones or so on, I would very much doubt that anything really happened there, but no disrespect to them. But you will see that this car came from absolute nowhere and timed it perfectly so that when the bus came, he almost hit the bus, but instead went into the obelisk. You can see the way it's filmed. Check out the way it's filmed if you go on YouTube and so on. You will see the camera go up the obelisk and then down the obelisk, and then it pans out to see the bus coming. The timing is perfect. And right when the bus comes, boom, here comes the car right through the crowd. There's, I think, four people that are thrown to the sides. If you look at the film, you will not see any of them where the car is actually hitting the people. I would strongly suggest that there's something very weird going on here, because you will see these people being rolling down the streets, but you will not see them when the car is there.
No.
Also, nobody is taking photos. You know, they're just, I mean, here we are looking at the Queen. And nobody's taking photos. Nobody's taking photos of the car. Where are all the photos that would have been here or filming of this sequence? You will only see the official version or some press photographer's photos of this event.
Yeah,
Okay,
that's
so.
remarkable. What I've heard, Ola, sorry to interrupt you, is that maybe the car was taken over by remote control, and that the guy who was sitting in the car was actually trying to warn people in front of him, but he could not steer. He could not do anything else other than honking. How do you call it? Making noise.
Exactly. That can very much explain the honking the horn, because somebody was on the way there. Very possibly that it's been remotely controlled, and I would say from someone with an aerial view, most probably some kind of helicopter or someone who could see the whole setup. You know, what I'm saying is not a real event, though. If people were hurt, then it were done by design. And if you see, as soon as the car hits, there's a police officer, I think he's on a bicycle, and he just runs up to the car and stands in front on the side of of this car, so that you can't see into the cars. You can't see who's in there. It's very, very hard to see. And then there is a still photo where he's sitting, the guy, the so-called driver, he's sitting in there with a bloody head and so on. I would very much question these photos. And then also, if you are into the structure behind this global elite, one of the major parts in this world government, this hidden world government, is the so-called Bilderberg Group that was created in Holland, 1954, at Hotel Bilderberg. They just took the name. And if you see where the bus left, because the bus just carried on after this incident, and the bus went straight up just a few hundred meters to Hotel Bilderberg, where the press center was later established in there as well.
Yeah,
So
that's very meaningful, of course. Yeah,
very, very much so.
Yeah, fascinated all with what you are saying. It's magnificent. There's not much time left. This Sunday is exactly 10 years after the murder of Theo van Gogh, and he was investigating the murder of Pim Fortuyn, who would have been prime minister in the Netherlands if he would not have been assassinated a few days before the election. Did you also look into those, for the Netherlands, very shocking murders?
I have looked into them, but not enough to say anything. I try always to stick with what I know a lot about. And
Exactly.
I would prefer not going to this, but I would very much say that when an assassination happens like that, just before an election, then look at the power structure behind it. Who would gain from this person being eliminated? And very much look away from the lone crazy guy, the lone patsy, the extremist, and so on. They always want to blame it on one single person, a crazy guy. The reason why they want him alone is because then there's no planning, there's no conspiracy behind it. If there's more than two people involved in planning a crime, that is what is called a conspiracy. They want to avoid the conspiracy so that they can only blame it on one person. This person can very easily they can suicide him, they can kill him, they can stuff him away very quickly, and get rid of it. So case closed, thank you folks, good night and bye bye, go home.
Yeah.
And the reason they want him crazy is because then there's no motive. Or if he's extreme, they love the extreme thing, blame it on the Muslims or blame it on whatever, then that will explain it. But you need to see, you need to take a step back or take a step up, look on a wider, give it a wider perspective and see what actually happened there. And you will see that sometimes also these assassinations are done just days before an election to force the population to make an emotional choice in the election. They did it with the Anna Lindh murder in Sweden. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, I do.
It was on 9/11 in 2003, I think it was, where she was stabbed. This was an election where Sweden was going to elect the euro or stay with the Swedish krona, and she was pro-euro, So when they saw that they were losing it, I'm not talking about on a Swedish level. This is way, way above. I would say this Dutch thing as well, way above Holland. It is way, way bigger.
Yes.
If you look at it as a Dutch assassination, you're making a mistake, And so when they couldn't get the people to vote pro-euro, they wanted to go emotional. So they hit one of the key people that would get the emotional impact. So they killed her in a very brutal way to get the emotional reaction. And they almost got away with it. So the people, out of sympathy for the victim and her family, voted on her, but they did. And if you see the train bombings in Madrid just before the elections as well, trying to force people to vote in a different way, they do it again and again. And so it's very important to be aware of the patterns and what is going on in society at the same time, and get out of the view that this is on a national level. This is international. This power elite, they call themselves the elite, I call them the minority, but this power elite, through groups like the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Committee of 300 and so on, through these very, very hidden groups, at least some of them are very secretive, it's in those networks that you will see how these things are planned and carried out. And they see the world as a corporation where the countries are just like franchises. So This is through these networks. This is why you will see that something is happening in the US, and then suddenly France is doing exactly the same, and Sweden neutral, they do the same, and England are following exactly the same. How come? How strange is that? No, not at all, because they're members of the same club. You know, they follow the same agenda behind the scenes.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. We don't have much more time left, Ola. What do you think we should do as a humanity to end the terror of this minority?
Is I say don't use violence in any way. Violence is their language. If you use it, they will crush you. They are so that's their ballpark. That's they know that they know violence and they will just squash us, you know. Instead, we need to do this in a non-violent way, but totally fearless by exposing them, by exposing their methods, by becoming aware, by waking up. Because they have only been able to get away with these things because we have not seen what is going on. So now, if I have any say, by aiming the spotlight right at them, identifying their methods, the tools, how they carry them out, and the template that they're using, and the members, where they're meeting, how they're meeting, the agendas, and so on, we will eliminate the threat from them. It won't work for them anymore.
Exactly. Exposure and non-violence.
Total non-violence. And if it's okay, Johan, I'm not a religious person, but I have a prayer that I really love when it comes to this. If it's okay, if I
Yeah, of
just,
course. Go ahead, please.
it goes like this. May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who hurt us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light. The thing is, we need to heal this planet, you know. We need to heal it. We need to heal these people that are so-called evil as well, because they live in a very, very dark world. And they will continue until they're healed as well. You know, so in one way, in a very twisted way, we should indirectly thank them for being so horrible, but because apparently we need this amount of atrocities to wake up. You know, I think life has tried many times to say, wakey, wakey, hello, hello. And then we haven't woken up, we just changed the channel and ordered another pizza. And now here's the sledgehammer, you know, okay, if you don't understand it, well, this one, what about this one? And boom, this is where we are today. This is a time to wake up. And I think every one of us have to look in the mirror and see, am I in any way or form part of their agenda? Am I doing things that is helping their agenda? And in that case, really consider to take a step out or somehow do your best to stop it. It's by design, it's totally compartmentalized so that people only know their little part, but more and more people, especially people in uniform and so on, need to wake up big time because this is moving forward very fast and it needs to stop. And this is, I would say, a wonderful time to be alive because this is now when it's happening and we have a chance for the first time to really see what we can do of this beautiful world if we can just transcend this obstacle here.
Thank you very much for these spiritual words, Ola. I didn't see this coming, but you're absolutely right. We are part of the problem, and only when we understand that and we embrace the totality and share our love and light and knowledge and also and everything, our wisdom to the situation, then it can heal. So that's what we should do, and I fully agree with what you've just said. Thank you so much for doing that.
You're most welcome, Johan. And anytime you want me back on, you know, please, my head is full of this information. Just use me, use it, let it get out there and be useful.
Yeah, I'll surely do that, Ola. For now, our time is up because we have another radio broadcast coming directly after this show. So for now, thank you very much for what you've shared here. And anyone who wants to know more, please go to the website lightonconspiracies.com, where you can buy the ebook from Ola, and it's only 20 euros, and you have 1,100 pages full of facts and full of pictures and evidence, And by then you will surely know what's going on. And when you listen then to this radio broadcast and understand that it's that we have a job here to heal our planet, to heal humanity, to heal everything, then I think we've done a marvelous, we gained a marvelous insight. So thank
also,
you.
Also, please sign up for my newsletter if you want to follow it. There's a real support.
Okay, great. Yeah, you can do that also on the same website, lightonconspiracies.com again. So again, I want to thank you very much for being my guest, and I'll probably invite you soon again. Listeners, thank you very much for tuning into Pateo Radio, and hope you'll do that at the same time next week again. Bye for now.
Hickox could be headed to a face-off with officials in Maine. She's the nurse that's confined against her will in New Jersey after caring for Ebola patients in West Africa. Hickox is staying at an undisclosed location.